Mrs. Baldwin, would you like to tell us about your childhood, some of the memories you might remember?
Yes, I will gladly. I was Hazel Bell Whiteford, the daughter of Clarence William Whiteford of Whiteford and Ada Bell Kennedy of Churchville. I grew up near Crestwell at the old stone house on Route 136 from Bush to Whiteford. I attended Harford County Public Schools and had some teaching for high school. I always enjoyed it. I was taught at home for high school. I loved to make things. I was brought up in my home with my parents, and I was one that was an athlete type. My sister was. I was one that loved to sew, which my mother taught me very well to sew very well. And I loved to paint, and I made things, and I was interested in helping her with the colored woman in the kitchen. And I went on from there, and when I married in May the 16th of 1928, my husband Fred Baldwin of Aberdeen, and he was the son of Joseph Robinson Baldwin and Mary Jane Foley of Jersey City, New Jersey. We are parents of two children. Our first child was Betty. She's married to Edward Bryant, who was a physicist, a retired one from the BRL at the Proving Grounds. They have four children and four grandchildren. Our son is Fred Baldwin Jr. He grew up, went through the schools, went on to college in Florida. He married a girl, Joan Polini from Rochester, New York. They are the proud parents of two sons, both married and each have a child. And when I married and came to Aberdeen, it was such a quaint small town. But as it is today, and I'm not so proud of it today, it has changed through the years. It's nothing like when I married Freddie in 28. I came to Aberdeen, it was a quaint small town, and all the homes were well kept, the sidewalks were swept, the streets were clean, and everyone knew each other, and you spoke to each other, and you learned to know, and they were all acquainted. And we went to church. I went to Grove Church, which we all did, and I helped with the church, with the choir, junior choir, Sunday school, clear through and into the schools with the children, and helped with many affairs at the school, with civic affairs. I was the last president of the Ladies Aid Society of Grove Church, which takes you back, gives you a little idea, because we've had circles for quite a while since then. Now let me see, let me go back and get myself straight. And when our daughter was in school, she was very proud. She was the queen of her senior year of school. And since our children married, we have always been very interested in our town and county affairs. Oh, take that down. You're blinding me. We have been interested in politics, and I helped my husband with his politics, and if you go back and look at the Aegis paper, there I have one in a frame that was done by Robert Wallace in the Aegis paper of Fred Baldwin when he was county commissioner, when he retired. That was a grand write-up, and it said Fred and Hazel were teamwork, and I was quite proud of that, and we have it framed. I am a member of the Colonel John Street chapter, DAR chapter, who's my third great grandfather. And I'm also a member of the Daughters of the Cincinnati DAR, who I went in through my fourth great grandfather, Joshua Rutledge. I served our county as chairman of the Harford County State Bicentennial Committee from March of 1971 to November 1979. I have compiled a book of Harford County women and constructed the way for the book titled Henry Harford, Last Proprietor of Maryland. I also had the privilege of overseeing and distributing 100 plaques to the old homes of Harford County during my tenure. I was made Hazel Baldwin Day, August 29, 1978, by proclamation of Harford County Councilman, signed by Charles B. Anderson, County Executive. I also spoke on Radio Women's Week, Harford County, Maryland, March 8, 1981. It was taped at WBOB Bel Air and put on all Harford County stations requested by Mrs. Barbara Kramer, a Harford County Councilwoman. I have served on many in many capacities for the school, civic affairs, church, held many reunions. We'll hold another when my Wyford book is printed. Who came to America in 1720, settled in northern Hartford, was then Baltimore County. We came from Renfrewshire, Scotland, into Ireland and into America. I still have connections in Edinburgh, Scotland, a Reverend Robert Wyford, the Presbyterian minister, which I have searched back and to organize into 1250 or less. My latest endeavor was to organize a February garden club, which was successful in February 1984, called the Boxwood Club. We have 15 members. I never became a social climber of playing cards. I was always busy doing things which I thought were more valuable. I've always loved history, people, and places. We were taught to see and self-respect, to receive respect, and principles which make character. Always speak to others as you would like them to speak to you. Yes, Aberdeen has changed drastically, much to my disappointment. The old shingle house next to us was the old Aquila Baldwin, Fred's uncle, house that was where the Grove Church is now. Moved on this lot and added to, it's the oldest house in Aberdeen. We sold it in 1939, much to my dislike. It is made of logs. The Baldwin home place across the road where Fred lived with his family. Mr. Baldwin died in 1936. We lived in it until sold. It was built by Fred's dad in 1906. Fred was 1 year old when it was finished. He was born on Old Post Road in the Charles Austin homestead in 1905. Mr. Baldwin rented it until he had his own built, as he had his own business now. I don't want to make a noise.
Well, that's great. It's informal, so.
Now, is there anything more you would like me to speak of?
Going back to your childhood, can you tell us about some of your schooling and the teachers you knew?
Well, I went to Old Hartford Furnace School. It was a grade school from first to seventh. I graduated from there, and I started Delaware High School. And we didn't have buses in those days. You had to walk to meet the bus, or someone take you from Crestwell to Churchville at Halton Store where you met the bus. I was a sickly child as a young child, and I had to withdraw, and I was humped up. My mother taught me at home. There were six of we children. I was the second oldest. We loved our home life. We were on a farm. Our father was a Democrat by politics. He was a county commissioner. He'd been a supervisor of the county for 8 years. We just had a great life, and we had plenty of help on our farm, colored and white. We respected all, and my mother did all her canning. All of our meat was preserved. All of our bread was made. Everything we ate came from the hand, or from our fields, or from our gardens. That takes me back until when I married, and when I married, I was well qualified to keep house because my mother had taught me well.
What type of duties and responsibilities?
We all had chores. Mother gave us chores, and we never disagreed. We never argued. My mother respected us, and we respected her. We never had any arguments, and when we came to the table, we sat there and we spoke when we were spoken to. And we were never supposed to be impudent. When we went to school, we were to teach respect our teacher, same as our mother. We were taught that she was our stepmother for the day, and we had to respect her. And if she had to spank us when we got home, we'd get one from them. That's true. That went right down the line. I had sisters and brothers. We all had a great time together. We would ice skate. We sledded. Mother would make hot chocolate and donuts for us when we came in. And we just had a great life. She played the piano. We all gathered around the piano, and our friends, as they came in, we sang. We would go out until we were 18 years old on dates, had to be home by 10 o'clock, and the men had to be gone. And if it wasn't, Dad would rap on the floor. So, no, we were reared properly. We had places we could go. We were never allowed to run into public places. We were never taught. And we went to Sunday school and church at Old Cokesbury Methodist Church at Abington. And we used to walk until my older sister could drive the car, was old enough, and then we could get the car to go. But I remember all those good days, all my friends at Abington, and we're still friends.
Hmm. Do you want to just maybe share a story or experience that you remember from your childhood during, say, one of the winter days or the summer with your skiing or not skiing?
Well, yes, I can come up one real quick. We had many, but when it snowed, we lived at the stone house at Creswell, which is now is a horse farm. And it's the gatepost with a line on each post. And it was quite a long lane. And when it snowed in those days, it snowed and filled the lane up over clear into the fields. So we all, in those days, women, girls, did not have slacks. You did not wear pants. That was a no-no. You wore dresses. And we used to wrap our legs in paper and then put our boots on. And we would go out and prowl in the snow. So we were going to see if the mailman had come, who was Mr. Charlie Hawkins from Bel Air, see if he had come. So we were, three or four of us, gathered and got ourselves all fixed to go out in the cold weather and down through the snow. And going down this lane, there was honeysuckle on this one side, filled with honeysuckle. And my sister Helen, who was married to George Conley, lives here in Aberdeen. And we were going down this lane, and all at once she fell in the snow and she was a-screaming, and we said, "What's the matter with you?" She said, "Something's biting my back." Well, my older sister Marguerite up and didn't know what to do, so I pushed her down on the snow, hoping whatever it was to disturb it or chase it or whatever. And so we found out a mouse had come through and up her clothes and gone in and bit her back. So, and another time, yes, we went to the Creswell store. We used to thrash our wheat. And Mr. Ben Sarcable was the thrasher, and Mother sent Marguerite, the oldest one, with the team, hook up to the buggy, went to Wallace Rogers Stewart's Creswell to get some, I think it was a ham or such, different things you need because you had to feed these all these men. So we took our sister Helen with us, which we didn't want to, but she Mother made us take her. And when we got up there, she had 11 cents for holding in her hands, and we were in a hurry. So when we got in the buggy to come home, coming around the bend, she fell out of the buggy. And we finally got stopped, and she gathered up her pennies, and she ran back to the store, and she got her 11 cents worth of candy. In those days, you got a huge bag of candy for 11 cents. But there are many more, many more, many more. No, we enjoyed ourselves. We six children played. We had neighbors. We had time to go and time to come and time to sit and time to do. And no, I appreciate my days. I often wonder now when with our children, when they've had so many privileges in the home, I often wonder from where I was reared as if it really is beneficial to the children of today. There's television and there's everything. Of course, you should be together more, but there's more silence in the home. No one talks to anyone. And those days, it was a radio, and you didn't play that too often. It was a battery. And times are just different. We had more time for everything, and we learned things from our parents, and we believed in our parents. And if they were right or wrong, you never gave them any impudence. You just took it and went on, and that was it. And we grew up, and I think it made us better citizens to be mothers and fathers of our children. We had something to pass on to them.
On the farm, what type of farm machinery did you use in some of
the farm? My father had, he was well equipped for those years. It was all John Deere, and you had your binders, you had your plows, the horses plowed them. Later years, tractors came. And you had all of your equipment, and Dad had three colored men all year round. They lived in the orchard, in the little houses in the orchard. And we had one colored fellow. They called him Uncle. He was a little short thing, had real nappy hair, and he came walking up the road from Baltimore. So we found out. We stopped by, and Dad was down the other lane doing something, and he stopped my father and asked if Dad needed any help. So Dad brought him up to the house and showed him what was there, and he was a little fellow. Then he took care of the garden and raised all the cantaloupes and watermelons. He could grow anything. He was from the African gold mines in Africa, and he told us he had stowed away on a ship from Africa just with a loincloth on him and came into Baltimore, and he jumped the ship. And he had been living in Baltimore, and he was living with some woman, and she was cheating on him during the day, and or during the night when he was working or such, and he up, and he said, killed him with an axe, and scared him almost to death, so he left the city and he came to the country. So, but he was a brilliant fellow. When we children were doing our homework at night in the kitchen, if he happened to come in there for something, and when he told us where he was from, he took our geography book and went to the map of Africa and showed us exactly where the diamond mine was and told us how they used to steal them in the hair, used to swallow them, put them in the mouth, said they stuck them every place they could to steal the diamond. And, well, anyway, so he was quite interesting. And he was no dummy. He spoke perfect English. And I know Dad had racehorses. They were the sulky horses. We had another fellow from Virginia, Len Stewart, who took care of those. And I used to help Dad to paint these colors on his buckets and things to get ready to go to the wherever he left in the early spring. And Earl Gusswaller from Aberdeen was the man to haul him in his truck with the sulkies and everything. And those days they raced it more at fairs, at the Harrisburg Wedding and Allentown and many places, and I used to paint his colors were green and white. And Pop was a gentleman farmer, and as I said, he was a contractor, and before he was supervisor of the first district from 1918 to 1926, Mr. Jim Morris was county commissioner at that time, and he asked my father to serve as his supervisor in his district, and Dad did. And of course we had to live where he could house all of his teams and such, but before that he had just completed a job of laying his teams and men with help, laying the water line from Vanderbilt into Edgewood Arsenal. And that was back in 1917-18. And of course, that brought us over to Emerton to live, and while he was there, and we rented a home for Mr. George Norris over at Norris's Corner at opposite Center Road, torn down now, and that's where we went to school at Old Stone House at Emerton, down over the hill for a year or so while Dad was there. So then we went over to the other place, and that's where we stayed.
About your free time, what type of books or music, you know, dances did they have while you were growing up?
We had to have parties in our own homes. In those days, you didn't go to public places and run to public places. You were invited. It was all by invitation, and you had your own parties in your own home. Now, when I was 18, my father gave me an 18th party, and he said, Hazel, it's your coming out party. See, Dad was from the street and Langford family, where they have a lot of background of a lot of aristocrats. Mm-hmm. So Dad said, this is your coming out party. So they gave me a birthday party, and my uncle, Walter Russell in Baltimore, who had a bakery, and he baked my birthday cake, and it came in a great big dish of basket, pure white with silver leaves and flowers and all, but it was gorgeous. And we had the Mitchell boys from Calvary, Snake Lane, that played for us. We cleaned out the living room, put it in another room, and we danced. And it was, and the people were there, it was from by invitation only. Mm. And that was my 18th birthday, and I made my birthday party dress, and I remember it well. Mm.
What was life like when you were getting married? What was the new change of atmosphere from your family to your new home where you were?
Well, I can explain that. When I married Freddie, we came and lived in Aberdeen at the Bolden home place, right across the road over here. The big home over here that Freddie's daddy built back over there. And I lived there from May to June. From May to November, and we moved into a place that was owned by Mr. Baldwin, but we rented it. We were all on our own. So it wasn't any different, only you had to learn to know your in-laws, other than that, and all the sisters and brothers of the husband, and to get acquainted in a new town of Aberdeen, because I was reared, and my mother was from Churchville, and I visited Grandmother Kennedy there, and my father's mother lived in Baldwin, in Baldwin County, and I visited there. We used to go to Omar and Paul down the railroad to Baldwin Station, got off, and Grandfather used to come to horse and buggy and pick us up. So we went lots of places, none to Baltimore to visit my father's sisters. Not, well, we were a very close, woven family. Daddy was a family of 12 children, but they reared 8. And they all married, and they, some in Baltimore, some in Baltimore County, and Philadelphia, different point. So we had plenty of places to go to. In those days, it was family-oriented. You visited families, and when families came to visit you, you dressed your table as if the queen was coming. You put your best silver, your best tablecloth, the best everything on, and served them as if you were serving strangers. You served them well, and they always came back, maybe too often.
Well, was your change of life, how was that different from when you grew up to when you moved to Aberdeen? How was that different?
Well, it wasn't, I can't say it was different because we lived our same way. The way we'd been taught, our home was the same. Our home was highly respected, and our children were taught to respect their home and to respect us, and I reared them the same way my mother did us, and taught them the same principles and self-respect as we had been taught, and I thought that was the proper way. They were taught to go to church and Sunday school, and the same as us, to go to school. We helped with the schools, well, everything that needed, anything they needed from. We lived at the home place then, and everything they needed at the school when they had a problem or whatever they had, they always came to the Baldwins for the roses, for the wheelbarrow, for a chair, or whatever it was. But we willingly did it, and I was happy to do it. Think we had it, but we could do it. And we had many children. We started the first teen town in our garage upstairs here. They had a Victrola, it was electric. And the first teen town was a group of children went to school with our children. And a lot of them came here during World War I in 41. And they built Lee's Village out back here. And there were little homes, and there were many a person lived in there. Were a fine background, fine people, but they lived in these little old cheap homes. And a lot of people of Aberdeen didn't think they were worthy of your friendship. But I didn't see it that way. I was taught differently by my mother and father. And we learned to know them. They went to school with our children when they were in this home. And when they came to my home, you had time to observe those children and to learn it and to know those children came from good background. And they were trusted. When they were in school and having their school dances, they'd come to me for the corsages. I'd call Mrs. Max Salmon. She gave me a reduced price for them that they could afford to pay for. Well, those that couldn't go to the dances, we'd take them. And the little fellows that had their little girls for the first time, the parents had no way to take them, we'd go and take them home. When they had their school sports, he and I hauled all the children through grade and high school. Both he had a truck and I had a car, and we'd take these children to the schools. If it was Ellicott City, no matter where they were going, we took those children because school buses didn't take them in those days. So those children and we had a great time together, and they still write, still come to see us and think the world of us, and we are the same of them, and their children growing up the same way. No, we've had a great time. Great time.
When did you start to get interested in the politics?
My father was in politics, and which my mother didn't care for. And then when he came along, Freddie was town supervisor in Aberdeen for 10 years, and he ran, people of Aberdeen came to him and asked him. He was a town boy, and people knew him, and they were all town people. They didn't have the influx of the overgrowth of outsiders as they have now. But anyway, in 1969. Anyway, he ran for county town commissioner. He was town commissioner 3 times. But he was still town commissioner when they asked him to run for county commissioner. That was before county council. County council came in 1972. And that, he had 4 years to serve, but he only served 2. Then he was reelected again in 74 and served until 1978. And they still ask him to run for the fourth time, and I said, I'm against it. I won't go with you. I've been through these fields, every field in Harford County, every corner. I've stood and waited on him. I have been to things I didn't want to go to. I've been on the range, hot sun. No more for me. I'm through. But I'm not going to say wish you luck because I don't want you to run. So, and he lost. Not, I won't say it was due to me not that being there with him, but he lost. It was time. He had served his capacity, and I thought, and he'd given his whole life. He managed baseball. He played baseball. He played football. He played soccer. He went to Calvert Hall. He played soccer there. He played soccer for Harford County. I don't know. He was in sports. He played ball on Eastern Shore for home run Frank Baker. He was with the Orioles. He was signed up with the Browns, Kansas. He was in baseball all my life. I wasn't a baseballer. I was more daintier, I mean to say, a little more. I just like to dress up and go sit down. And sometimes I like sitting on the front porch instead of dressed up going to a baseball game. Well, I had to fall in line, go to the baseball game, because that was my life. Because the children came along, they were interested too. They all played ball, played basketball, played soccer, played everything. And so I had to get acquainted with it. So I got with it, and after I did, I served them very well, helped them many ways. Helped him to pick out the baseball suits, we go to Baltimore. Helped him pick out the baseball suits. He also sponsored soccer, the boys and girls after they got out of schools, home teams. We found the uniforms and found everything and sponsored them. And so we've had a great life. We haven't had any time really to sit back. But in my due time, I have compiled a book on my family, the Whitefords, and I do this summer hope to have it printed. And I've been since 1949 with that book. Working on it. So I hope, and I've done the Baldwin book, I've done my mother's Kennedy book, I have the Street book, those are my two great, my grandmothers were Streets, and I have plenty to do. I don't have any idle time. No idle time.
Well, when you were helping your husband in politics, what were some of the things you did for, say, fundraisers around the campaign trails?
In 1966, that was the first year he ran for county commissioner, I was made chairman of Teas and Coffees for Harford County. And it was up to me to find the homes for him to go into, and to one thing, I didn't care when it ended up, I was told by the committee that sponsored me and appointed me to serve him that, and when I called these people in different sections through the county so they'd have an area covered, and I thought it did very well, and the people answered it and served very well. They were very, 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 very courteous and did a great job. And anything that I'd call them, I hated to say it, but I was told by them to say, we will refund you for your donuts and coffee. We will allow you either $11 or $8 or something, or we will sponsor that. When the time came, it was all over. They didn't have a cent to sponsor anything. But these people did it on their own, and even when I called them and when I made that little statement, they said, oh, we're willing and glad to do it, but still I had to say it. But when the time came, there wasn't any funds at all. No funds at all. So there were times in politics that you tire. And one thing in politics, I'd never be false. I would never tell a person I'd vote for him if I couldn't. There's a way of being polite, saying you haven't made up your mind or something or whatever. Freddie never asked a person to vote for him. He's never asked a person to vote for him. He's never asked for a cent. We sponsored it all ourselves. And I don't know. You run across a lot of things that you agree and disagree with. And one thing I won't do is be a polyester. I will not second. I'm me, what I am, and I like being honest.
Or can you tell us about some of the other committees that you...
When we first started out with our bicentennial, there were quite a, I have the names all in a book, I have handwritten 3 minute books. One is in Annapolis, one is at the Hall of Records in Annapolis, and one has been sent to the headquarters of Bicentennial Annapolis. Now, another, I have a few more little things to add to hand. When we had to give up at the Bicentennial, when it retired, I was asked to name a place that anything, whatever we had accumulated that we had left, where would we give it? And I said, well, the only place, the proper place that I think for it is with the Harford Historical Society. It is our society of our county, and they should be recognized. So I have given them some things. I have a few more things yet to give them. Then in the meantime, there were things that, when they asked us where were we going to put our things for the county, what were we going to give to the county? So I went to Charles Anderson, who was the county executive at that time, and asked him would he have made a cabinet so we could put it in the courthouse beyond the Bush Declaration that's on the wall there as you go up the steps. And so we could put our memorabilia in there. And they did. And it was Mr. Jack Tipton who made a very pretty one, and asked me many times to come look at it and see if I liked the grain, liked the color, liked it all, and it turned out to be very, very pretty. And there are things in there that have been disturbed when they laid the new carpet or whatever they've done with the courthouse since it's been renovated, the old part, since when they put the new one. And I do have to go up there, and I hope we arrange a lot of things that's left in it. And I'm not sure, but it looks like some things are missing or such. I don't know, but I'll know when I go back. That was one great thing. But then again, we were cut short on things to give. What we gave was by our committee, the Bicentennial, the State Bicentennial Committee is what I put in there, because we had 3 towns of Aberdeen had their own bicentennial. Of course, I was over them, but they operated on their own. But it was Haverty, Grace, Belair, and Aberdeen. And that was almost 3 separate things. And they wanted to maintain and keep their own. So Haverty, Grace has theirs. Belair has theirs, I guess, in the town office in Belair. I've not seen it. And Haverty, Grace, I don't know where they put theirs. And Aberdeen, I don't know. Probably in the libraries. I don't know. But I've not yet been told where they placed what or seen what they put away.
When you refer to things that you collected and gave away, could you maybe tell us about some of those?
Well, for an instance, there was a plaque, there was a declaration for the Bicentennial that week was in to serve the 200 years. I think it was signed by President Nixon at that time. And Senator John Moore from Virginia also had to sign. And I got one from him, and I got one, a book from Sarbanes. It's in the thing. They're all in Bel Air in this case, the things that I received like that, they're in the case. We had a bicentennial tree, and it was the old rye oak down on old Joppa Road, and it's been cut down. The winds destroyed it, and I understand it's been cut way back, but the bottom of it, and it will produce, I understand. And we had pictures taken of it. And it's hanging in the courthouse. I presented one to the courthouse, a picture of the old bicentennial, of our bicentennial tree. We also had 100 plaques made. Mr. Holmes and Bel Air did those. They were made of aluminum and baked. And they are, I'll show you one before you go. And they were never erode. And on this, it has, you know, we have another one. We, for the Bicentennial Committee, we had to have our own logo. So we put it in the schools of Harford County, grade and high, and to the public to come up with a logo for our Harford County Bicentennial. And it was a woman that won it, and her name is missing my mind right this minute. She was a winner, and I know her name well. But it's not with me right this minute. Well, anyway, and so we put that on. And the definition of it. I have one I'll give you. I'll give you one. So that was another project. And then one of the main projects was to find the Bush Declaration, the minute book that had been laying underneath on a table in the courthouse beneath the Bush Declaration that's on the wall. Do you want to cut that for a minute? I don't like this. One project I would like to enclose was I was very interested in the mural of the Bush Declaration on the wall and to who had painted it and when. So, much to my surprise, in December the 22nd, 1983, I read the Aegis paper in the last 50 years and I came across Mrs. Lawrence Ewell was the person who was the artist who had drawn the bicentennial of the Bush Declaration on the wall. And it was selected by Mr. R.J. McKinney, the director of the Baldwin Museum of Arts. And I found the size of it and how come she had done it. And she served her candy well. And it's so beautifully done. I was just interested in who had done it. So this answers my question. So in the meantime, I was interested in to learn something of the history of Mrs. Ewell. So I called Mrs. Margaret Stump Shaw, the widow of Alexander Shaw, Alex Shaw, and asked her if she knew her. She said, yes, Hazel, I knew her, but Mrs. Harriet Rogers would know better because she rented from her a little stone home at $5 a month for about 2 or 3 years. So I called Mrs. Rogers, and Mrs. Rogers gladly spoke with me and told me Mrs. Ewell was a fine person, and her maiden name was Marion Butler. She was from Connecticut, and she was quite a renowned artist. She had displayed her art in Paris, Philadelphia, New York, and such places, and she well qualified, so I was interested in to know something about the lady. So she told me that she was that she remembered her well, and she was a small woman of medium height and dark hair. She was very neat. She entertained a lot. She was very pleasant, and she always entertained in her long skirts, and Mrs. Rogers were always invited, and in later years, they bought property in Falston. And the property was called Poverty Enclosed, and Mr. Ewell was an architect, and he was from St. Louis, Missouri, and he designed a home, and they lived there until Mrs. Ewell died about 2 or 3 years after they had built the home, and Mr. Ewell had remarried. So that answered my question as to who had done the mural on the wall. Mm-hmm. Now, another thing I would like to get back to was the Bush Declaration book. When we first started with our bicentennial, the book was missing, and it had been gone from the courthouse for quite a number of years. So the day that I was appointed at the Harvard Community College in our first meeting, after it was over, James Wallen, the architect, he's a member of the Harvard Historical Society, said to me, "Now, Hazel, maybe we can find the Bush Declaration book." And I said, "Well, James, that is a hard thing, but I'll try. I have no idea where to start." So, in the meantime, in Bel Air one day, my husband was coming up the street, and George Vandover was coming up the street, and he was a distant relative of mine through the streets. So, he stopped Freddie, and he was talking about the book and different things, and he says, "You know, Fred, I bet you Mary Risto could tell you or has that book or could tell you about that book." So that gave us a clue where to start, not knowing if she had or could find it. So we did. I picked up the phone and I called her and I told her I needed it because Ed Bull was doing history of Harford County for the Bicentennial Committee and he wouldn't accept us to start where we wanted to with the Bush Declaration because he said he'd never seen a copy, had been approved, and this and that, and he just wasn't going to sanction it, and we couldn't start there. So I needed the book to get started. So she says, "Call me back in 2 days' time." So I called her back, and she says, "I have the book." So we went up, we got the book, and Freddie went. I didn't go. And we're having a meeting. Luckily, we're having a meeting that night here at the house. We met always at this home. So I presented the book, and Ed looked at it, and he still wasn't satisfied with it, but he wanted us to start with the Stamp Act in 83, not in 1776, 1783. So anyway, that gave they all read it, and they all said it was there, and they did look at it, so they got our feet off the ground, and we got started then from then on to go where to go and what to do with our bicentennial. Mm-hmm. But Miss Louise Gore was the state chairman over all the counties, and I met her many times. She visited our home, and she was quite cordial and a very fine person, and the whole committee was very fine. Mm-hmm. And how I was chosen, I was wondering. I didn't know how come, but the Wyford Streets, Kennedy's Golf, Bays, Herbert Hall represent Harford County many years, and the Bells and the Bays, and but that's all in our families and many more, but I didn't know how come, but I got a phone call from Baldwin one day. It was Alan Constance, who was the son of a Methodist minister, and he was from Wales. His dad, Ed, was a minister at Cokesbury Church when we were children going to Cokesbury mm-hmm. Church. So he called and asked me, would I serve Harford County Committee as chairman for the bicentennial? And I said, Alan, that takes somebody with a shoulder as broad as an ox and a head as huge as a watermelon to contain all this. And he said, oh, you can do it, Hazel. And I said, well, you haven't seen me for a long time. I don't know. But anyway, he says, you can do it. So I said, will you give me 2 or 3 days? And he says, I'll give you a week if you want it. So anyway, so I thought it over, and Freddie says, Hazel, you can do it. You know the people, you know the county, you know where to put your fingers on things, and you do it well. So you can accomplish that. You can do it. Well, that gave me confidence. So I called Alan. I said, Alan, if you believe in me and you think I can do it, then much to my surprise, I'm saying, yes, I'll do it. So I did. And that's how. And through, he was also working with Judge Wilson K. Barnes, who was on the committee for the state of Maryland. He was the president of the committee at that time, and Louise Gore was the chairman. Well, anyway, I worked with them, and we turned out, I guess, what we did was all right. It seemed to be, but I'll tell you one thing, we never asked, the county didn't finance us in any way. We put it into areas. I called, it took me 1 week on that telephone to take a map of Harford County and draw the area lines, and I knew people within those area lines to call to ask if they would serve as chairman for that area. And I did, and it took me a week, I'll say a week, time to call this one, they couldn't, and then somebody else, and I don't know how many in one area, but anyway, I accomplished it, I'd say in a week. And I met for 1 year with those people every Monday morning at Bel Air in Cortland Street in the county-owned building there upstairs with, I don't remember now the number of women that served in the county. They were all women that served those areas. And they never got a cent. They never asked for a cent for gasoline or a cent for a stamp or anything. And they did it and did it well. Never cost the county a cent. They were dedicated people from the heart. And they believed in their country. And another thing which people don't realize, when that became about, was started, we were having riots and things were not so pleasant. And here we were celebrating 200 years. To us, it meant a lot. To others, some, they were disgruntled, dissatisfied. And there was a lot of things that they tried to prevent us from celebrating. They wanted a person who believed in God, who believed in Jesus Christ, who believed in the flag, who believed in prayer, and who believed in church, and who just would stand up and salute the flag and all those things. Well, thank God, I was one of them. I'm not bragging, but I was one of them. I don't know how they knew it. I mean to say that I did filled all those capacities and represented it well. So I had no problem because I felt well at that time. But I will say, when I was sworn in and took an oath in a holiday motel here in Aberdeen, Louise Gore and the ones that swore me in were there and had a luncheon. And when I raised my hand and when I was duly sworn in as the chairman for the bicentennial of Harford County, I will say, with all that meant, the first thing went back to my mind was my mother and my father. My mother was dead. She died in 71, September of 71, and my dad died in December of 52, and the first thing went to my mind was, oh, Mom, Dad, if you could just be here, and my mind was of them. And then that took me back to all the things in that Wayford book that I wrote. Now, my grandfather lived with us in the summer and with his daughter in Baltimore in the winter because he had the gout. And grandmother had died, and everything was sold, and he came and lived amongst his children for winter and summer. And he was with us from March until almost Christmas time, after Thanksgiving, before he went to Baltimore, because we kids and he just adored him. He said my mother's children never sassed him, gave him any trouble. And Aunt Greenway said they were sassy and they did dirty things to him. He said, God bless him. He would sit and tell us all these things. Now, he was a Wayford, from Wayford. His mother was a Street, from Street. And all family was closely woven. Everybody knew everybody's business, who was who and what was what. And if they had anything to tell on anybody, they never let the children hear it. They'd go upstairs in another room and shut the door. You never heard it. You never heard what they were telling about each other. So that didn't make you gossipers, but we knew they were gossiping. So he told me all kinds of things about our family and where this was and that was. And I was about 12 years old when he told me that, and I said then, if I live to be old enough, have the time, knowledge, everything it takes to do this, I'm going to seek him out. And I did, and I found, and he really led me to a lot of things. He gave me the background as to what to pick up and what to go and where to start. And that's where I started, and I found that that man really told the truth. And now I'm going to tell you one more thing, that my grandpap was sitting out in the yard one day, and it was hot like it is now, over at the stone house, and had a long bench opening between two maple trees. And he had the gout, the foot was propped up, his cane was beside him, and poor old soul, he was rather warm. He said to me, Hazel, as I said, I was only about 12 years old, he said to me, Hazel, you go in the house and ask your mother if you can make me a mint julep. I said, Grandpa, I don't know nothing about a mint julep. Dad had whiskey in the house, and he played cards with men in the dining room, and no one was allowed. The door was shut, and they played cards in the dining room, and then he had a box of cigars on the table, and the cigars were there, and he made his own cider, and he'd go down and get a pitcher of cider and put it in there, and the men, if they drank whiskey, whatever they had, we never saw it. We knew nothing about that. Mother never allowed us in the dining room to pop. So Dad always had a bottle of whiskey in the house in the pantry for his friends. So I went in and asked my mother. Mother says, oh, I wouldn't, Hazel, you know I know nothing about that. I said, well, I'll go ask him if you say I can do it. I went out and I said, Grandpa, tell me where to start. He said, Hazel, get a tall glass, mash the ice in it, put powdered sugar in it, and down to the spring house, we had peppermint growing around the spring house. And take that peppermint and mash it, put it in that glass and pour the whiskey in. I said, nothing else? No, the ice melts it, and pour the whiskey in and stir it up a little to get the mint and sugar. I took it out to him. He said, Hazel, it's the best one I ever had. And that's how I learned to make a mint julep. I didn't think it made any sense though, but that's how I knew how to do it. He said it helped. It was a hot day and it helped me. So that was Grandpa, but he was a great man. He was a wonderful little man, and told us all about the streets, the different things up there. And now, do you want to hear one about another street? Do you want to hear another one of these?
That's all right.
He told me one about my grandmother's aunt. She was 18 years old, and she was Almar Street. And it's in the stone house up at Bush Corner of the streets where Campbells live now, where grandmother and all the streets were born. Now, they never went to public schools. They were taught by governesses at home. They never attended public schools. My father did, but not my grandmother, not his mother. So anyway, they had a young German fella named Klutz. And he was 17 years old. He was from Germany. He was white. And he helped on the farm. He came by looking for work, too, and they hired him. And I don't know where he stayed, but they fed him in the house at the kitchen table. And he would come up from the barn, walk across the front porch to get into the the kitchen ran clear across one end. And you come from the back into the kitchen, or you come across that long porch. It was dining room, living room, hall, and into the, and he'd always come across that porch to come to the kitchen door. And it made him angry, because if it had been clean, they had plenty of servants, they had a lot of slaves, had a lot of, anyway. So it made my grandmother's aunt angry. So she told him not to come that way anymore, come to the back door. So, and she was the one who was always up in the morning and supervised breakfast with the help. And she was the one that told him what they were going to eat and all about it, and sat there with him while they fixed it, whatever. So this one morning, she was sick. And this young 18-year-old one went down in the cellar. I don't know what she was doing in the cellar, how come with help, I don't know, anyway, but she went down in the cellar, and they used to smoke fish by the barrel. And they had a barrel of fish, and they were going to have fish this morning for breakfast, and she was leaning over in the fish barrel, taking out fish, and this young fella came with an axe and cut her head off in the fish barrel. Mm. He got the wrong one. And there was a tree down from the front yard, down around one of the field, the borders of the field, divide the fields, there was a tree. They hunted him and found him, and he was hung on that tree. Now, not, as far as I know, that tree is still there. It was there, not too many years ago, my last visit to that place. And it may not be done that, but that old tree was as dead as a doornail, but they never took it down. That tree stayed there.
Oh, why did he do that?
He was angry. He was a German boy, and he got angry. And anyway, he just wasn't going to let her tell him. He was white, too. You come in the back door. And I guess that got him. I guess that set him off.
It's horrible.
And it's in the history books. I mean, of the books in the library. Yeah, I forgot what book it is in there. John Lisby came to me and showed it to me. And I have a street book. Compiled all the streets. That was done in 1895. Mm. And it's in that book. But there's lots of things. But as I said, I remember our sledding and skating one time. My father's sister came up from Baltimore, and she was 18 years old, and we were all sledding out on the stone house out on the hill, and there was a branch at the bottom of it. And she came out, there was some young fellow there that she was looking at, kind of interested in, and she didn't come out dressed to sled. She came out in a good brown coat with a fur collar and all done up, and got on the sled with someone, went over the hill and went in the branch. She came out wringing wet. She was all wet. She was all dressed not to go skating or to be sledding. But no, there were many, many things that we're very fond of. Are there any more you want me to tell?
They mentioned one about when you go looking for duck eggs or something.
Oh, now that was misquoted. We were coming home from a bus trip down south, and George Sprague, who was the man, name was sent in and nominated by George Sprague, sponsored me, and I didn't know anything about it till afterwards. And we were coming home on this ride. Freddie had fallen asleep, and George and I started talking, and I said, we were talking, he was talking about home, and we were talking about things when we were children, and as to comparing the things of today, what we did to occupy our mind, instead of having to have paid everything to teach you how to pick up a ball or what to do, we made our own play. We occupied our own brains and kept our brains going, and the experience taught us a lot. Instead of everybody being paid to show you how to do this and do that, you never did it on your own, and many times you lose interest in it too. You don't have the interest you had when you did it yourself. Learn to do it from the very beginning yourself. So yes, we had chores. That was one of my chores. My mother would say to me in the summertime, we had raised our own turkeys, our guineas, our ducks, our wild ducks, and got from Bob Light the eggs down at around a point, and Dad would set the eggs beneath a chicken hen, and she'd hatch those out. And that's where we got the wild ducks. But the turkeys, if you knew anything about a turkey, they are the most cunningest thing you have ever seen. And these old turkey hens, Mother wanted me to find where they were nesting. And she'd say, follow her, watch her. Well, you'd be hours in that hot sun fooling with that old turkey hen, and she could fool you. I lost her. And you'd wind around and wind around and wind, and Mother would send me out to hunt to find where this old turkey was sitting with these eggs. And That's all was said about eggs. Then I said Dad got the turkey goose eggs or the wild duck eggs from Bob Light, Mary Light at Otter Point, because they raised them, and he would set them beneath the chicken head. And George Sprague got that confused in some way. I mean, I didn't collect the goose eggs. I don't, that's how it came about. I never collected a goose egg. I had to watch the turkey hen and see where she was nesting, so I could tell mother so they could keep an eye on her and to get the turkeys when they were hatched out. So that's what that was all about. No, I was quite surprised when that was read off in that thing at night when Fine Hutchins presented me with it here at the town meeting in Aberdeen. One night they were meeting and he came up with this proclamation and read off the goose eggs. My eyes just bugged. And of course, the only thing I could do was reflect right back to just what I just told you now. There were never any goose eggs. I wouldn't be too proud to say, but no, that just didn't exist.
While you were in politics, what were some of the people that you met, like the other councilors and the county commissioners? What were they like?
Well, the people that we, at the time Freddie was on the board, when he first started out, it was three. It was John O'Neill, Howard Coburn, John O'Neill, and Freddie. And Bob Archer was their councilman. I mean, was their lawyer, their attorney. And, well, the Archers and the wife, which had been friends for years, and young Bob's dad and my father were very great friends, had been for years. And my mother was from Churchville, and Bob's first wife, Bob's mother, were the four was from Churchville. They knew their family. My father's sister and his mother were very great friends. And we knew the people, because through my father, and when he was in politics and all, Bel Air was where we visited and shopped, and Bel Air was no new acquaintance to me, only it had changed a lot too in the years. But where the county building is now, that's where the jail was. And my Uncle Steve, my grandfather's brother, was county sheriff. His father was county sheriff. His father was county sheriff. And that's when they got a slave. Was the last slave that died in Harford County was old Mag Giles, when my great-grandfather died in 1853, Michael Cook Whiteford. He was the one that got this little slave from the almshouse in Bel Air when she was 12 or 13 years old. And she lived to be 115, and she was the last slave of Harford County, or probably many places. And I have a picture in my Whiteford book lying in a casket dead. And Willie Whiteford, Dr. Whiteford, my cousin, took the picture and gave it to me. So, no, I knew all of them. But we weren't strangers. We were families that went to church and went to oyster suppers and helped with things at schools and churches, and we were all acquainted. We weren't any strangers to the county, and we didn't find it hard at all. And I enjoyed a lot of it, that part, because Hallett's wife, Ella, and I got along splendidly well. Doris and I got along. Lewis, John's wife, I knew her father, Mr. Sneffy. He was at Edgewood, and he and my father used to breed horses together. So I knew them, and they were only strangers. The only strangers were the new people to come into the county later, but we were well acquainted with all. When Marguerite, my sister, and I were young girls, and Dad was in Bel Air, we were up there, and we went to the dentist or where we'd been. We were around the courthouse a lot, and my sister worked at the courthouse making out filling envelopes for the county taxes and sending those out. And we were in the courtroom, and Judge Preston was just related to my father, and we knew all the lawyers and knew all of them, and they used to tip their hats, and we were just young kids. And I said to Glasgow Archer in Bel Air the other day, the last Glasgow Archer, and I said, "Oh, Mr. Archer, you're last of the Mohegans, as you call them, or the Musketeers. I said, you're the only one left in Bel Air of that group that tipped your hat to ladies." And it's right, as far as he's got the only one, he'll tip his hat if he has a hat on. If not, he'll go like that to you when he sees you. And no, they weren't strangers to us at all. We were well acquainted with them. And I thought more of there than I did any other part in Harford County, except Whitefield, where my father came from, and church where my mother. But I really knew it, I guess, as a whole better. And no, they weren't strangers. And then when they went into, and then when Tommy Hayden came on, Howard Coburn was appointed to something by the state, and Tommy Hayden was appointed there for a while. Claire, we've known Claire and Hayden, the family from Haverty Grace, knew his grandfather and all of them, and they were not any strangers. John Clark was the lawyer later. He and my father were great friends way back. Mm-hmm. And no, they weren't any strangers. Harwick, I guess, we knew less of. John Harwick and Charlie Anderson than any, because I knew A.B. Henderson, because we all went to Bush River Boat Club together. And also I didn't know Bill Dietz as well. He was a newcomer to Harford County. But we learned to know him, and I found him a very sociable, friendly person. And his wife asked, but he used to tell us, he said, she won't go any place with me. He said she likes... Not at all. I went to the fairs. Miles Hanna was the president of the school board. He married my cousin, Carolyn Wyford. We were no strangers. Francis Silvers, he was one of the first ones served on Park and Recreation. When we first started with Parks and Recreation, he was on the committee with Miss Nancy Webster Barnes from Churchville, who my mother had known, lived all her life. And they weren't strangers. And Francis Silvers, the Silvers are in the Whiteford family, married many times. And he used to come here, and he and I would sit and talk and have a lot of fun. And before he died, Freddie and I forget who else presented him with a plaque for the different things he had done on the county and for the county. Very understanding. And then later, as the bicentennial group grew very large toward the end, we met at Bel Air at Parks and Recreation Building, and it was Rex that's the one invited us there, and it wound up with John Weber was the last one when we finished up there, and we had a room there. They were no strangers, and I didn't find any of it strange. It wasn't difficult. I felt right at home. And I was happy to have served, and I am a member of the Harvard Historical Society and have been for quite a while. I'm a member of Lyra Dendron. What else? And the Stepping Where Life membership paid up of the Stepping Stone. And I between the two DARs and the Boxwood Club and the things we have, we're very well trying to complete a lot of that. I've started to write these books. I don't have a minute. I just hope to live to be able to accomplish all that I've started. And I've loved every minute of it. And if I didn't, I couldn't have done it. And I'd marry the same man over again. We had our quarrels. Now, when you say when you get married, the first thing you have to do is learn the disposition of your husband and personality. And that wasn't too easy because he had things pretty much his way. But I still would marry the same man over. He was a great father and a great husband.
Over the years, what changes have you seen, such as in Whiteford, Bel Air, and Aberdeen, like the old Candies that used to be here?
Listen, that is one of the horrors of Harford County. People, that's how counties started, on mills and canneries. If you go back to the beginning of the stumps, the Dallums and all, they had mills and canneries. They all started with mills and canneries, and that's how they established their homes and all those acres of land that they acquired. And here's the lady for you, if you have a few minutes. Well, anyway, Freddie, go to the door. So anyway, yes, because I remember when my father was on the farm. Freddie, go to the door, because I when my dad was on the farm, and before him, all of them, they took fields and they had corn, wheat, and tomatoes, things that they sold to these canneries or these mills. And I remember my father, he sold his corn to Eugene Billings at Churchville, where the little thing opposite of the road you grab down, it's where Ben's King House was, that's gone. And they canned corn for us, and Mother would get the cans and they'd mark it, and we'd go, they'd process it for us. And same way with the tomatoes. Mr. Albert Jersey over at Harford Furnace did our tomatoes. And you took Mother, we helped Mother in the cold one in the kitchen, and we would put as many as 10 or 11 cases of tomatoes canned, and they'd send them, and we'd mark them with paint and put them in your cartons. Send to the canning house, and Mr. Jersey would put them all on a surveyor belt at one time and run them around, drop them off into the can, into the boxes, and we'd go pick them up and bring them home. And that's one of the great things we have lost, and I don't think it's been too good for the county or any place, because you got good food those days, and it was a good inlet, coming in for the farmers. And of course, you didn't get it till the fall of the year when everything was all gone up and shipped out and got the books out and counted up and they paid you. You got paid accordingly as to what they sold such and for, or they made an agreement with you. They'd buy a bushel of wheat for a dollar and some cents from you, or they'd buy a case of tomatoes from you for $2 or $3. And it was something. Mm. No, it's quite different. And old Bush Inn, I remember old Bush Inn very well. We used to walk by going to old Cokesbury Church. And the last one I knew in it was a card family by the name of Norton. Howard Norton had a whole lot of children, and they started cutting up the windows and doors, and wasn't much left of it, but anyway, old Bush Inn. So, now listen, I didn't complete something, and I, before, it's in between, it's a little off the track from what I said previously, but I would like to make a commitment one way. This Bush Declaration book, when I found it, I kept it here for about a year, and I got a letter from someone in the county, threatened me if I didn't turn that book into such and such a place, at 4 o'clock one day they were going to take me to court. Well, I didn't pay any attention to it. I was told by Bobby Archer, who was then assistant state's attorney, not to give the book up, and by John Lizzaby in Aberdeen not to give the book up, because we wanted to be put in the proper hands because it had been found, and not to lose it again. So Judge Close, Albert Close, another relative of mine through the streets, called up here one day around 3 o'clock, I guess, and said, Hazel, can you have Fred bring the Bush book to Bel Air? That's when they were talking of building a new courthouse or adding or whatever they were going to do, so we can see the book and measure it and where we're going to put it, because it's got to be air conditioned such to preserve the book, and we would like to see it and take the measurements. And he'd be here by 4 o'clock. I said, we will do. So Freddie left with the book. He took the book to Albert Close in Bel Air. That book I've not seen since. I've had quite a number of calls, where's the book? I didn't know then when they were calling me, and I'll tell you what I was told, or where I learned where it is later. We were at a Harvard Historical Dinner at the Maryland Golf and Country Club, and Ed Bull was there, and I think he was still president of the Harvard Historical Society at that time. I think he was still president. Well, anyway, if they read in the, when they were finishing up their minutes and their quarterly or minutes or their business, they read that, or John Lisby told that the book, the Maryland, or what they called the minute book, the Bush Declaration book, was in the hands of Maryland Historical Society. Now, they had asked me for that book, and I wouldn't give it to them, because I was told it's right in that book written. It belongs to Harford County. And it was the fifth book that had been printed. Now, some people have been printing from, evidently. And it was in good condition, perfect lettering. You read, and the paper was, you couldn't buy it today. It was linen such thickness that it had threads in between it, and you couldn't buy it. And that book, as far as I know, and they did make a statement that they had made provision for them to keep it until Harford County had a place of their own that they could keep it safely where it would be lasting. Now, I've had quite a few calls on that asking me, where's the book? I don't have that book. Now, I copied, and someone called me, I forget who it was, Ed Burgess, I approached, and at one of our bicentennial meetings about that book, and he said, Hazel, he said, well, the person did that, he's very sorry, doesn't know how he can ever make amend. I said, easy, pick up the phone and say I'm sorry. Easy as anything. I said, I will accept it. But I say, so far, it hasn't been done. Now, where that book is, if it's still with the Maryland Historical Society, or where that book is, I haven't any knowledge, but I have proof. And what I'm saying, by cutting from the paper, Aegis paper, that I gave the same thing I'm telling you, and it was put in the paper, and they visited the Judge Close, and he said, yes, that's true. And I cut the clipping out of the paper and have it in my book. So I have it there to clarify. And I also had the paper that I was, the letter I was threatened if I didn't take. Then someone said, oh, I bet you were the one stole it. You've had it all this time. Now, let me finish this up. I made a statement. I guess you're running low. I made a statement back that we were called by Miss Mary. I mean, we called Miss Mary Wistone. She said, give me 2 days, and if it's still there, I'll find it and call you back. Well, we called. Well, now, this I have not made public. But being that's going on this tape, and for the record, I will tell you this is what we found. Freddie went and got the book. And she said, Fred, this book, from what I understand, now she was slick, she didn't say positive. She always left, she's good knowledge, good thinking. What I understand, she said, Winfield Kane, that's Kathy Riley's uncle, saw this book laying in the courthouse, just dusted, no one paying attention to it. He picked it up and took it home for safekeeping. So she said, he's had this book and he gave it to me. Because, you know, he's dead, had been dead quite a while. And so evidently the book had been in the house of Mary Wistone from then on, but we can't say that it was. But anyway, we got the book from Mary Wistone. And as go back to the statement, as George Van Berber said, I bet you'll find that book at Mary Wistone's. Well, anyway, the book was found, and the last one that handled it was George Archer. He was the president of the Harvard Historical Society. Now, I understand few people have said they have made copies from that book, and whoever was the last one made a copy from the book, half of it, the writing's upright, other half, it's down. Tail end at the bottom, where it was, when it was stitched, the page was stitched. But it's there, and it's intact, and it's great. It's a great book. I copied as much as I could. I hadn't copied all of it when he called, but I have papers here handwritten. I can call it by hand. That was in, and quite a number of our wifers were in there then, were on the different, on the different committees. So that is, it is a nice book, and it's nice to see, nice to have. Now, they wouldn't tell me. Someone told me that that letter was written to me, threatening me. They thought came from the Aegis paper. No one's, they thought. Maybe it did. I don't know. But when you do a good deed, see, you still get blasted. But anyway, the book was found. So James Wallen, I don't know if you ever appreciate me finding it or not, but you asked me to. I did find it. So, is there anything more, a little further? Have I talked enough? I've had a great time. And you've been a good listener.
Is there anything else, like such as the roads or maybe the police? I know you were in Bel Air, are familiar with the police over there. The police chiefs and then...
Oh, my Lord, Gary Bowman, Reese Bowman, and all the sheriffs, we knew all of our lives. And sure, knew their families. We're still friends of Gary Bowman's daughter and son. We're still friends of all of them. Yes, that goes way back many ways. Mm-hmm. We weren't strangers. And if you respect people, you'll get along.
Oh, yes.
And don't repeat everything you hear. You'll get along. Because you know news travels fast, and good news sometimes good, but winds up sometimes bad news. So yes, no, we knew them, knew all of them, knew their families, knew them from way back. the Bowmans and the, well, there were two Sheriff Bowmans, you know, and Whittick came along, all the Bowmans for quite a while. And Street Bowman was a relative of mine through the streets, and he lived to be a very old man. D.D. Anderson worked in his office, and he used to fall asleep and fell asleep so many times that somebody said to D.D., why don't you run and take his place? And if they hadn't said it, maybe D.D. never would, but she didn't want to because she worked with him so long. She knew he was old and didn't want to take advantage of him, but she did run and run. So she did the county a great service. But as it goes back through the family, as Wilfield Wayford, Dr. Wayford's father, my father's first cousin, and when any of the family ran, you voted for him. You didn't look see what the kids were, you voted for him. So I guess that's how a lot of them got in. You voted for them. So as long as he ran, I guess all the family voted for him. Oh my. Well, it was in the paper not long ago, Harford County is going to straighten itself out. They're not going to vote as to by name and who you were and what you were. They're going to start voting in new ones. So they have, and as long as they do a good job, that's fine with me. We can't all stand here and be recognized as the first. We've all been first many times, many ways, and I'm satisfied with what I've done. And I just hope where I'm going is going to be as good as what I've done here.
Or is anything else you'd like to add in the last story or something about Aberdeen or any of the other areas?
You want me to tell you about Aberdeen? When I married Freddie 58 years ago, 1928, license were $2. And I thought I was only 8 miles from where I lived, but when I married Freddie, and I didn't know $2 license was going to keep me in Aberdeen the rest of my life. I have tried to get out now. Aberdeen's been good to me, been kind to me. But since it's changed like it has, and our friends like ourselves are getting up in years and are passing on, and we still do, but we can't. Well, when you're older, you can't do as you have done. But anyway, Aberdeen used to be quite different from what it is now, and since it has changed as it is, I could leave Aberdeen. Of course, in my dreams, I'd have memories of Aberdeen, because that's where I lived. But as far as being tied down to where I could say, no, oh, I'd go tomorrow. I've been acting for quite a while to sell here, but we built this when we sold the home place over there. And this was Baldwin land. All this strip was Baldwin land. And I guess he's the last Baldwin, and I guess he's trying to hold on to the last. We built this to rent, not to live in. So we're still here.
Okay, well.